Hello and welcome to another episode of In Conversation With by Kangaroo Minds. I'm Vedika and today we have with us Rashi Thakran. Before we introduce Rashi, I would like to put out a trigger warning for our audience. There may be certain topics which are discussed today in the course of this conversation which you might find triggering or distressing. If that is the case, please take a step back, take care of yourself, and if need be, reach out and speak to someone. If you need a list of support and resources, you can find that on our website as well. Now, I'd like to welcome our guest for today, Rashi Thakran, to our episode. So hello, Rashi, and thank you for being here. Rashi is a mental health activist, a social activist, as well as a change maker. She is also a certified QPR instructor. As part of the She Creates Change program at change.org, Rashi was instrumental in having a petition to urge the Indian government to launch a national suicide helpline. Her petition gained a lot of traction and led to the creation of Helpline Kiran last year. Additionally, Rashi also conducts several workshops on suicide prevention with the aim of making the conversations more mainstream and creating more awareness. Our conversation with Rashi today centers around suicide prevention, loss, and how to cope with grief. So without taking much time, let's dive in to hear more from Rashi. So Rashi, I think I'm going to start with the question, which I think, you know, you get asked pretty often, which comes from your entire lived experience around loss and suicide-related grief. How do you think your learnings from that have influenced you, especially like, you know, personally as well as professionally in terms of your work?
First of all, thank you for having me here, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I think it is so important that we talk about this aspect of suicide loss. When it comes to grief, you know, the biggest learning for me that has been with in terms of my journey is that grief is not linear. It's a very zigzag road. You know, it has its ups and downs. There are good days and bad days. Sometimes there are more bad days than good ones, and you have to sort of become comfortable with that in knowing that, you know, you will have those bad days. And the most important thing is that you will never be the same person that you were before all of this happened. So there's always that before and after when it comes to not just loss due to suicide, but loss in general. You know, there's always that before and that after. So there's that before that, you know, before the person passed away, you were a certain type of person, but you will never be the same. And I think you need to come to accept that as well. And yeah, you know, when it comes to grief, a lot of people think that, you know, over time it gets better. You know, people say things like time heals everything. That's honestly not true, because as someone who's experienced this firsthand, time doesn't really heal much, and the grief never shrinks. In fact, what happens is you tend to grow around that grief. You tend to sort of shape your life around that grief, learn to adjust around it, and come to terms with that new reality. So after my brother passed away, it's been 2 years now, more than 2 years. And the grief is still there, you know. Time has passed, 2.5 years have passed, but I still feel that grief. I still feel that void. But what I'm trying to do is still adjust around it, grow around it, take it one day at a time, and accept the fact that I will never be the Rashi I was before it happened. Things will be completely different, and that's okay. I mean, I'll come to sort of accept that fact and move forward with it. You, again, never really move on or get over it. You just move forward with all the love that you have for the person who has passed. So I think that's what I've learned from my experience of losing someone to suicide.
I think, you know, you touched upon important aspects related to grief. For instance, you know, like, you know, people expect that, you know, while you have all these models which suggest, you know, the stages of grief and things, not everyone is going to go through grief in the same way, and grief almost sort of becomes like that milestone, as you said, you know, your life clearly becomes a before and after that entire episode sort of happens. And as you said, it's not just suicide related grief, but grief in general, which does that to people. And, you know, coming to another point, just picking up from what you said, and was around, you know, if you can elaborate a little more, you mentioned that, you know, people don't move on from grief. And that's something they're told very often, you know, oh, it's been so long, get on with it, get on with your life, move on. Do you think, you know, is it more about moving on as much as it is about moving forward?
Yeah, no, I think that's such an important point, because like I said, you can never move on from it. You can never get over it or just get on with life. Now it is a part of you. And, you know, the trauma that comes with losing a loved one is immense. You know, it will stay with you forever. I know this was this episode, this thing, the grief, will stay with me for the rest of my life. You know, I will have some amazing days, probably, obviously, maybe someday I'll have good days. Like I said, I'll obviously have bad days, but this thing will never go away. And I don't want it to go away, because the thing about grief is, and this is an amazing thing that I read somewhere, is that grief is basically your love persevering, you know. All that love that you had for that person who has passed away, it's all of that love that you could not give to that person. Mm. That love sort of manifests itself into grief. And that's what grief is. And I think that's such a beautiful explanation about it. And it really changed my perspective that I don't want to think of grief as a negative feeling that I need to get rid of. That, you know, I need to be completely okay. And not grieve or not think about my brother anymore to be able to live a full life. No, it's a part of me. And the fact that I'm doing this every day, the fact that I'm thinking about him every day and grieving every day, it means that there's so much love inside me that I still have for my brother, and I always will. That's never going to change. So that's what this is for me, which is why I'm just moving forward with all of that love that I have for my brother, and just trying to manifest all of that into the work that I'm doing, so that, you know, I can honor my brother's memory every single day and not let the world forget him. I know I will never forget him, but I've also made this my mission that the world never forgets Raghav. So that's what moving forward means to me. And I think a lot of people will resonate with that.
I think, you know, another thing about is very often, which we don't realize, is, you know, like providing support in terms of mental health to the bereaved. You know, in terms of your journey, how important has that support been, you know, for loved ones? Because it's not just about the person who's gone. It's also about the family left behind and the loved ones left behind. Sort of them getting the support. And I think that is an aspect of, you know, suicide loss, which we don't talk about enough as well. So what are your thoughts on that, you know, based on your experiences?
Yeah, I think, again, that's a point that not a lot of what people talk about, and especially people who are grieving a suicide loss, like we call survivors of suicide loss, those people are the most ignored when it even comes to people dealing with loss in general. So people, let's say, who are dealing any other type of loss, they get more support than people who are grieving, let's say, a suicide loss. So that sort of stems from the stigma that we have, you know, the taboo that we have around suicide, because there are so many families, not just in India, but around the world, that, you know, when something like this happens to you, they don't even want to acknowledge that it was a suicide. Okay. And that's something that I experienced personally, even within my extended family. So when I was starting my petition around suicide prevention, and I wanted to talk about my story, I was literally putting it out there into the world, into the limelight. A lot of people told me not to do it, because they just wanted us to, like we discussed earlier, move on from it and just forget about it. a lot of my extended family members even told people that it was an accident and not a suicide. So I think when that happens, when there's so much internalized stigma within your family, the people who are the most affected here, the immediate family members, which in our case, it was me, my mother, and my father, they don't get the kind of support that they're looking for or hoping for. And that's exactly what happened. We just felt like we were cut off from the rest of the world. We just felt completely isolated, because a lot of times it's that thought that you have that just no one will understand. People don't even want to accept that this happened to us. They're probably ashamed of it, or they don't know how to talk about it, etc., etc. So that just sort of adds to the misery of the family members, and that's what happened with us, which is why it was even more important for me to open up and talk about it and start a conversation wherein I realized that I might not be the only one. You know, there are so many people who are losing their lives to suicide every day, so many family members who are becoming survivors of suicide loss every single day. And all of them are going through a similar scenario, similar situation, similar thought process. And maybe if I can start that conversation, let people know that, you know, it's okay to talk about it, and you deserve support, you deserve to be heard, you deserve to be healed. I think that's the kind of message you want to sort of send out into the universe. So yes, I think the bereaved family members require mental health related support. They require emotional they require, you can find, for example, bereavement counselors or support group. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better.
Yeah. Do you want me to repeat something, or was
I think okay? You were mentioning about, like, you know, support and just sort of around bereavement. So I think, you know, what you mentioned a lot, I think that came out from what you just said, is around that, you know, the loneliness which comes with being bereaved by suicide, and how families feel alone. And it's not just families, it's also friends. It's that entire ecosystem around the person who's no longer here. So how do you feel that, you know, as individuals around those people, that we can be more supportive to someone who's been bereaved by suicide?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that anyone and everyone can do in terms of supporting someone who's been bereaved and who's grieving in general, it's not just, we don't just limit it to suicide loss or grieving for suicide loss, but just grieving in general. I think that's acknowledgement, you know. The thing that we crave most when we are grieving is someone to come and tell us that, you know, it's okay. You know, it's okay to be in pain. It's okay to be hurting. All of these things are natural. It's bound to happen. And, you know, we're here for you. We're here, and we will sit with you in this pain. Instead of trying to sort of distract us, right? Like, what people tend to do is, and I don't really blame them, because they don't know any other way to react, because they just want their loved ones to feel better in any way possible. So what they do is they try to give them certain ideas, or tell them that, oh, you should do this, maybe this will make you feel better. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, you know, you should go travel, or maybe you should do something. They try to sort of tell you that, okay, maybe this will make you feel better, and they try to distract you from that pain. While it comes from a very pure place, it does more harm than good, because in that moment when the person is grieving, they just want to remember the person who has passed. They just want to grieve. And I think letting them do that, and letting them know that it's okay to do that, is the best thing that you can do. And that's where acknowledgement comes into the picture. So, you know, if you're someone who doesn't know how to support a loved one who's grieving, I think this is the best thing you can do. Just be there for them in any way possible. Sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You just have to be there, just sit there with them, just maybe give them a hug or hold their hand. It could be those small gestures which can just go a really long way. And if that person tells you that they need some space, also give them that. Because a lot of times people who are in that state of mind, in that space, they just want to be left alone sometimes. So obviously, if they tell you to, you know, let's say back off, or just tell you that, you know, I need some space, it's okay to do that. But at the same time, keep checking in on them. Make sure that you, instead of saying that, reach out to me if you need anything, just say that, you know, I will keep checking in on you if you need anything. So make it active instead of passive. Don't wait for them to come to you, but keep regularly following up and checking in on them. Because obviously at that point, they will not be able to reach out to anyone.
Right.
So, you know, so I think that's another way that you can help.
So let me see another thing now, coming to the second part of our conversation, which really centers around, like, you know, suicide prevention, and you've been a certified, you know, suicide prevention instructor as well. You know, a lot of times they say that many of the suicides which actually take place, that there are enough warning signs out there, which people tend to, you know, miss out on. So can you tell us, like, you know, what are some signs that, you know, people could look out for, which might suggest that an individual is experiencing suicidal ideation, or, you know, might be contemplating taking their own life?
Yeah. Again, so important. So, you know, I just want to mention first that while there is no particular list of warning signs that, you know, this is the sure shot list, and these are the things to look for, there's no such list, because suicide is such a complex issue, and there are so many different combinations of signs that might be there. So you know, just putting that out there. But at the same time, there are some ways that, you know, you can try to identify and help out a loved one who might be thinking of suicide. And there are definitely different types of clues. So the first is direct verbal clues. If you know, a person just comes up to you and directly tells you that they are thinking about suicide, do not take that lightly. And the direct verbal clues could include something like, I want to kill myself. It's very direct, and obviously throws you off, and it, you know, just hits you in the face. But at that point, it's really important that you don't take that lightly. Or it could mean, I'm just going to end it all. Or something like, if this and this happens, or if such and such happens, I will kill myself. So these are those sure shot direct verbal signs that, you know, someone is thinking about it. The other is indirect verbal clues, where it's a little more subtle, but at the same time, it's even more important for us to be more observant and make sure that we ask that person, what do you mean by that? And this could include someone just coming up to you saying, I'm just tired, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I'm just so tired. That could be a sign. Or, you know, pretty soon you won't have to worry about me, or everyone is so much better off without me. So these are things where the person is not directly using the word suicide or kill myself or end it all, but they still are trying to reach out or tell you something. So again, keeping those things in mind is important. The third part of it is behavioral clues. There are a lot of behavioral signs as well, which could include, you know, someone giving away their prized possessions. Someone is, you know, very irritable, moody, or they've been diagnosed with a mental health illness like depression or PTSD or bipolar disorder. So we need to be a little more observant and not ignore that. At the same time, you know, there are sudden changes in behavior, let's say. The person is sleeping too much or sleeping too little. You know, there is some sleep disturbances or sleep deprivation. That's a major, major clue in a lot of cases. Or the person is eating too much, they're binge eating, or they're not eating at all. So if you see these sudden changes in behavior, again, you know, ask them what's wrong. You know, don't let it just slip, but ask about it. And also, if there has been, let's say, you know, a previous suicide attempt, that again is a very, very major warning sign, because people who have already attempted suicide and survived and haven't received the help that they needed, they are much more likely to attempt it again. So again, that's something that we need to be a little more mindful of. And the fourth part of it is situational clues. There can also be a lot of situational signs. For example, a person has just been fired or they've lost their jobs. So there's financial instability in the house. There's an exam that they've failed, let's say, or they're very stressed about their boards. A lot of suicides happen because of that fear of failure, especially in India, especially within the students in India, the student population in India. It could also be something related to relationships. There's some relationship problem. So, you know, that's another area that we need to look at. Maybe a person who has been recently bereaved, you know, they've lost a loved one. And that's again, you know, coming from a lot of experts, that people who have lost a loved one, not just to suicide, but to any other illness, or let's say accident, those people are more likely to attempt suicide themselves. So we are a more vulnerable population. So you cannot ignore that. You need to be a little mindful of that. So these are some signs, you know, there are direct verbal situations.
You know, so you've given us some of the signs. Like, you know, one of my concerns around talking about suicide, which a lot of people feel, is that, you know, if someone is talking about it, they're not going to do it. Or, you know, that this is just an attention thing. You know, they're just saying it for attention. They're not going to actually go and end their life. So what are, you know, your thoughts around that? And how do you think we can end that part of the stigmas, you know, especially that?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's very important to understand that if a person is talking about something as serious as killing themselves or ending their lives, they're definitely not doing it for attention. And even if they are doing it for attention, it's because they need that attention. You know, it's because they're not getting that attention, they're not getting that support, they're not getting that help. That's why they're going out, and actually it's a cry for help. And it's good that they're talking about it, because then we can do something about it, you know, instead of you not even realizing and losing the person. This is still better, where you still have a chance. So you know, don't say this like it's a negative thing, that, oh, she's just doing it for attention, or, oh, he's just doing it for attention. Maybe they need that attention. Maybe they haven't got that attention in a really long time, and this has just escalated, and probably this is their final cry for help. So yeah, that should not be taken lightly. I think that's, again, the perspective that we need to change around that, because, you know, so many people, and especially with social media, so many people write about these things on social media, which often go unaddressed, or which often get ignored. And then, you know, a few days later, you've lost them. So don't take those social media posts lightly. Don't take those expression or those cries for help lightly. I think that's all I want to say to this.
You know, another thing is that if you're concerned about a loved one, you know, who you think might be contemplating suicide, and you may not be an expert, but how do you think you can still help that person, you know, in that situation?
Yeah. So this is something that I talk a lot about during the QPR training that I take. And as a QPR instructor, I've realized that, you know, there's so much that we as loved ones can do for the person. We do not have to be professionals. We do not have to be therapists or licensed mental health professionals to be able to help someone. All of us have that power to save lives. And I think the most important aspect here is that if you think that your loved one is thinking about it, if you are concerned that they are contemplating suicide, be forward and ask that question. Don't wait for them to come to you, but just be forward and ask that difficult question. And I think that's the most difficult step for a lot of people, because they just don't feel comfortable enough to ask the S question, what we call the suicide question. And that sort of stems from that misconception that if you talk about suicide with someone, you will probably plant that idea into their heads, which is, again, absolutely untrue. It's quite the opposite that happens. You know, when you ask someone about suicide, it's more likely that a person will feel safe enough to open up to you, and you will establish that trusting relationship where the person can come to you and tell you everything. So that's where a lot of people just sort of tend to back off and say, oh, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. But I think the best thing that you can do is just be forward with them and ask them that. Now, once you've done that, you know, once you've gotten through that first phase, and the person open up, people open up to you, the person opens up to you, it's important to know how to react to it, you know. We need to be conscious of how we react to that person telling us that, oh, I'm thinking about suicide or I'm thinking about killing myself. Because a lot of times, and I don't blame anyone for it because it's a very normal reaction. So the most common reaction that people have when someone comes up to them and tells them that they're thinking about suicide is that one of fear, denial, or anger. These are three most common reactions that they have. You know, there's that fear that, oh my God, how do I do this? Or there's denial that, you know, no, this is not what you're feeling. You know, you're just overreacting or you're just being dramatic, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that denial that, no, you're not feeling this way. And the third thing is anger. You know, you're projecting your anger on that person saying that, how can you even think about this? You know, don't you care about your family members? Don't you care about us? Don't you care about people who love you? What will we do after you're gone? Or say things like suicide is a crime, it's a sin, God will punish you if you do something like this. So these are some of the reactions that people most commonly have. But it's important to understand that we need to consciously suppress those reactions and instead cultivate reactions of empathy and compassion. And then shift to, you know, active listening. We need to listen to them actively instead of reacting this way. We need to just sit and listen to them, be non-judgmental, be open, you know, be compassionate, and not give them any advice that they haven't asked for. So, you know, cultivating these skills, I would say these are definitely, active listening is a major, major skill that we need to cultivate. So cultivating these skills will really help you, you know, being able to reach out to your loved one and getting them the help that they need. Now, once you've done that, obviously the next step is to convince them to seek support. And that sort of stems from the compassion and the empathy that you've, you know, practiced earlier, where you say that, you know, I acknowledge your pain and I care about you. I really care about you. We'll get through this together. Just let me know how I can help you. Or let's just go to a professional so that, you know, we can talk about this and we can get you through this. So that's obviously the next step. And then once they are willing to talk to someone, you know, it's important to make sure that you get them to that resource. You know, just don't do a half-hearted job at it, but, you know, actually maybe carry those resources around you. Have numbers and contacts of therapists and counselors that are verified and that you trust on your phone so that you can just share it with them. Or go a step further and book that appointment for them. And maybe if you're physically close to that person, if you're in the same city, let's say, accompany them to the therapist. Because a lot of times these people, they're not able to do this on their own. It's very, very difficult for them to do all of this on their own. So they need that support system, that constant support system. So maybe doing these small things can make a very, very big difference for that person. So yeah, I think these are some of the things that we should really look at cultivating.
Like, you know, another thing that you mentioned, Rashi, was around, like, you know, being empathetic, being compassionate, being non-judgmental. Like, do you think, you know, that you said you could cultivate these skills. So could you tell us a little bit about how we can build on that skill? You know, how we can all be better listeners, how we can be, you know, non-judgmental and, like, sort of restrain from giving advice? Because I think giving advice comes pretty naturally. You know, if someone tells us they have a problem, we're most likely to come and, you know, give suggestions, give advice, come from our frame of reference. So how do you sort of refrain from doing that as well?
Yeah, no, that takes a lot of practice, a lot of conscious efforts. And, like I talked about earlier, that these are very natural and normal reactions. So I won't even blame anyone to sort of do this. I know that I used to do this all the time. But ever since I've realized that, this is how we should be reacting, this is how we should not be reacting, ever since I've educated myself and I've learned and unlearned a lot of things, I've realized that, with practice I can do it, and now I'm a completely different person. So I think it is all about unlearning a lot of things. So, once you unlearn those behaviors, you will be able to learn those new behaviors as well. So that basically comes from, reading a little more about it, doing trainings around it. Like, so many people who do the QPR training come and tell me that they have felt the change and now they're practicing it. They're trying to be more empathetic. They're trying to be more non-judgmental. So attend some of these trainings. Learn from people who have been through these experiences themselves. Learn from people who have had lived experiences. Talk to them. Understand their perspective. Understand their life, their story. And you will realize that you had so many biases. You had so many misconceptions, which are now slowly getting cleared. So I think it's all about unlearning a lot of behaviors. That's what I believe.
I think, you come from a space actually where you have, like, you have the lived experience. And a lot of people sometimes will sort of try and invalidate that aspect when it comes to having conversations around mental health. They'd be like, oh, you know what, you're not a psychologist or you're not a therapist. So why are you, part of this whole narrative? But where do you feel that, that lived experience aspect sort of enriches the conversation around?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. Wherein people, especially in the mental health space, they come up and ask you questions like, "Are you even a therapist to be able to talk about all this?" But that's the whole point. I am not a mental health professional. I am not coming from that perspective at all. Because there's so many people out there who do that as a job, and they're just so much better than any of us at that. And that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to tell my story. I'm trying to tell my experience so that someone out there who's going through something similar can probably feel like they're not alone. That's the whole point. That's the whole reason why I'm doing this, because I know when I went through something like this, if I had someone else to look up to, maybe someone who'd been through something similar, if I had that lifeline, if I had that support, or just that knowledge that, I'm not the only one, I'm not alone, that would have made a world of a difference. But that did not happen at that time, which is why I had to go through a lot of difficult phases before I could reach where I am today. So I just want to make that journey for other people who've been through something similar a little easier. And if my story helps, that's great. That's amazing. And nothing like it. So yeah, so that's where I'm coming from personally.
I think, as you mentioned, that sort of humanizes the conversation. You feel that someone else has been through it. And that's, I think, a very important part of it, that no, it's not just purely a pathological thing, which a lot of times when you hear from a mental health professional, like many, this person is just waiting to diagnose me. Or, they just want to get me to come to a therapy session or a counseling session. They just want it from that perspective. But I think when you come from a space of lived experience, or even as a QPR instructor, it's more of the awareness aspect, which brings a little bit of that human touch to the entire conversation, I think. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then another question that I wanted to ask you was, if we look at our entire society as a whole ecosystem, how do you feel that different stakeholders, be it the NGOs, be it the government, be it media, be it institutions, can play a role when it comes to, spreading the awareness about suicide prevention and actually preventing suicides? Because so far we spoke a lot of what we can do at an individual level, but what do you think we can do as a collective level on that?
Yeah, I think, honestly, if we want a large scale change to happen, all of these stakeholders need to come together. Obviously, as an individual, we can all do our bits. And, you know, like I said, we all have the power to save lives. But if we want any long-term changes which will sustain, we need these stakeholders to also work towards the same cause. You know, I have mostly, with my petition, dealt with government officials and with the government in general. And I feel there's so much gap there that still needs to be filled. And here I'll probably talk about the Indian aspect here, because we don't have enough funding when it comes to mental health programs. The funding is absolutely minimal. And the worst part of it is that every year the funding is further being reduced, which just goes to show that the government feels that mental health is just not as important. Or does not deserve the kind of money that we're even spending right now. So those perspectives, again, need to collectively change for some change to happen. We need more funding. We need more mental health practitioners, because the ratio right now in terms of the people who need help and the people who can give them that help is there's a huge gap. It's huge. So, you know, that, again, is something that we need to work at. A lot of NGOs and a lot of other stakeholders are coming up and talking about it and raising awareness. But I think now the conversation sort of needs to move from just the conversation or just talking about it to doing something about it, and creating those resources for people who need that support. So I think here is where the government definitely plays a big, big role. And in my opinion, the helpline number, the launch of the helpline number, is just the tip of the iceberg. That's literally just the first step. And there's so much more that needs to be done. So I really hope that, you know, all of these stakeholders can sort of come together and listen to the people who are really, you know, telling them that this is what we need, you know. And that's, again, where lived experiences come into picture, where people have gone through that and now they know what we need. So listen to those people, listen to people with lived experiences, and work together. Like, all of these stakeholders need to work together. That's the only way forward.
You know, one more thing around the semantics around mental health. You know, like, you know, how much does our language matter, whether when we talk about it on social media, whether we see it in the news, whether we see it in cinema, or even just in day-to-day conversation. So how do you think we can be more sensitive in terms of the language that we use? And what role do you think language plays sort of in building the whole narrative around suicide and suicide prevention?
Yeah, the language, again, plays a huge role, because how we refer to suicide, again, shows the kind of stigma that we hold, the kind of conditioning that we've had for the longest time, you know. So when you say things like committed suicide, or you say it was a successful suicide, these are things that we need to sort of, you know, take those out of our vocabulary. And the other aspect of it is not just related to suicide, but related to mental health in general, how we tend to casually use things like OCD or PTSD. You know, we tend to use this, even depression, we tend to use these so casually. Those are the thought processes, those are the things and the languages that needs to change. Because once that happens, we'll actually realize that, you know, this is how we need to sort of move forward. And when we use language which is trivializing mental health issues, which is demeaning people who are struggling with those mental health issues, we're really not progressing. So like I said, be it in movies, be it in TV shows, be it in the media, how suicide is portrayed, how mental health in general is portrayed is really, really important. And especially, you know, talking about suicide and how we report suicide in media, again, that is something that's very, very alarming right now. So those languages need to change. Don't, you know, for example, there are so many guidelines for it that, you know, you're not supposed to divulge the method of suicide. You're not supposed to glorify or sensationalize suicide. you're supposed to always give a helpline number when you're talking about something related to mental health issues or related to suicide. So always give a verified helpline number at the bottom of the screen. I'm not sure how many channels are doing that. So again, those are some things that we need to work on. Yeah.
See, another thing we tried now is the new normal. So what is something that, you know, you hope to see as we move into that, you know, new normal?
So, you know, the new normal word has sort of come into this picture because of the whole pandemic, because of coronavirus. I would personally say that for my family and I personally, our new normal began way before the pandemic happened. You know, our new normal was after losing Raghav. That was our new normal. That was our new reality. And now I think with COVID, with so many people who've lost loved ones to COVID, and people are still losing so many loved ones to suicide, because suicide rates are definitely on the rise. It's a silent pandemic that no one is talking about. We need to really pull up our socks here. I think in the new normal, I want people to obviously have those conversations, but at the same time, do something about it. Take actions. I think taking action right now at the grassroots level is something that I would like to see, not just in India, but across the world. And yeah, I think COVID, again, has really changed our perception around mental health as well, because so many people have struggled or are struggling with their mental health because of the lockdown, because of the pandemic. So yes, conversation has started, which is great. This is getting the attention that it has deserved for the longest time. But now what? What's the next step? And that's taking action. So I really hope that more people come forward, more people with lived experiences come forward. Like we discussed, more stakeholders collaborate and join hands to finally take action and do something about it. Shift from that conversation and towards action. I think that's what I hope to see.
And my last would be, Rashi, that, you know, what would be your parting words to anyone having a hard time with their mental health right now?
Yeah, honestly, to anyone who's struggling right now, who's struggling with their mental health right now, is I would just like to say that, you know, it's okay. You know, it's okay to be feeling this way. What you're feeling is completely normal. And it won't always feel this way. Right now, I know you feel miserable, but this is not going to be your entire life. This is not your entire life. It's just a phase and a part of your life. And things will get better. It's important also to, you know, acknowledge that and reach out to people who genuinely love you and care about you. And yeah, and I think basically just saying you're not alone. And I don't want anyone to feel that when they reach out to someone and tell them that I'm struggling or I'm dealing with this, that, you know, they're weak, because they're not. It's actually the complete opposite. It's a sign of strength to be able to open up and talk about your mental health and what you're struggling with. So I really hope you find that strength and you're able to reach out to people, to someone, and you get the help that you, you know, deserve. And I hope, you know, years from now, you sort of look back and you tell yourself that I'm glad that I stayed. I'm glad that I asked for help, and I'm glad I got through this. So yeah, I think that's something that I would like to say to everyone.
For anybody who's watching this today, please know that, you know, if you're having a hard time with your mental health today or any day, it is so important to just reach out, talk to someone, and know that there's always help available. There is hope. Things get better. They will get better, and you won't be in that same place throughout. So just reach out and, you know that you deserve to heal. You deserve to feel better. So just take that help. It is out there. So till next time, we hope, you know, everyone, you stay well, stay healthy, and we hope to see you again soon. Thank you.